ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A bowl of hummus caused Joseph Aboud an epiphany and set him on a journey. So in this Life Matters series, looking at the story of Australia through food, we're focusing today on Lebanese cuisine because clearly it's pretty powerful. In only a few decades, we've gone from not being able to source olive oil or spices to seeing things like shakshuka and labneh and hummus just about everywhere. How did we get here? Joseph Aboud is a Melbourne-based chef, best known for his Lebanese restaurant Rumi, which has been going for about 18 years now. And he's also written a book that's part cookbook and part memoir. It's called Rumi, Food of Middle Eastern Appearance. Joseph, I love what you did with the title there. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
We'll get to the hummus story soon because sure. I love it. But let's start with the story of Lebanese food more broadly in Australia because your family came here in the 60s.
That's right.
What was the landscape like then for cooking and sharing Lebanese food?
I think there was very little available to them, and they talk of bringing crates. You know, people would pack them. The families would pack them with crates of everything from coffee and coffee pots to for brewing Lebanese coffee, and the staples like olives and olive oil and za'atar and things that would travel. And it's amazing because there was none of that here, and they had to. I think they would wait for like every time a new family would come, they'd restock supplies and share those around. But there was even things like Lebanese bread or flatbread was unavailable, so they'd have to make their own. And the one story that sticks out is when they were a friend of theirs, actually not there, they were baking in the backyard in a wood fired oven, and the police came around because the neighbours were a little bit concerned about what was going on.
So you can incinerate your leaves, but you can't cook your
flatbread. Yeah, well, they were very concerned. They didn't know what it was. So I'm sure there must have been a gathering around that and all the rest. So that's what it was like when they came.
Well, that gathering is really important, isn't it? Because that's a big part of the food tradition that people brought with them.
Absolutely. So we still gather most Sundays at my parents'. Junior football gets in the way a little bit now, but most Sundays we're all there. There's 20 plus of us now with extended family, and it's a very, very important part.
Well, then, did that tradition help sustain people during some pretty hard times? The story of migration is often a story of really hard work, but it sounds like, too, there was an aspect of having to kind of lay low as a Lebanese migrant.
Yeah, well, I think like that story I just explained, if you are baking bread and the police come around, you obviously don't want any trouble as a migrant. And, whether it's stories of, in a city, Sydney, around Redfern, there's stories of people worried about the smells coming out of their kitchen and the fresh herbs and those sorts of things that people were suspicious of. Any number of stories like that, we hear them about all different migrant communities. I think they maybe not ashamed of it, but just didn't want any trouble. So keep your head down a little bit.
Well, there was a fascinating bit of history that came up when I was reading about all these issues that we're talking about today with you, Joseph Aboud, that the White Australia policy had this really complicated approach to Lebanese people. It was struggling to classify them in the complicated systems of the time.
Yeah.
What do you know about
that? I think
that?
Lebanese and complicated go pretty well together. So, mixed with the White Australia policy. I think there was sort of the Christian part of the community that, if you look deeper into the politics of it, may think that, it's a more European style there, or they were able to assimilate easier or what have you. And I think that was something that almost they would clutch to. And I think that assimilation is a little bit of a... sometimes I meet people that have been here since their family's been here since the 1800s, and you're quite impressed about how they've assimilated. And sometimes it's a little bit of a double-edged sword, that one. Sometimes it's a shame that they had to become so Anglo to fit in.
Well, and it's a loss to everybody not to have those smells wafting out into the wider world.
Interestingly, though, the food, I think, is the last thing to go. And I remember I was travelling around selling Lebanese beer, actually, and I did an event in Toowoomba, and there's a sizable community there of people of Lebanese heritage from early days of hawking. So they ended up in Toowoomba, and they were still cooking in this pub, this massive, every once in a while they do a big Lebanese feast. And, it was really amazing to see that after all this time that the food is the one thing that, because they were you know, completely assimilated in everything other than the food, which, you know, was very, very interesting.
Well, I love how you have kind of taken the food of your youth and run with it in your restaurant. And I know you have worked with people like Greg Maloof, who's also renowned for kind of sharing and elevating Lebanese cuisine and Middle Eastern cuisine. But how long did it take to change, in your view, Joseph, from, you know, having to hide the food to being able to bring that to a wider audience, and that wider audience being receptive to it?
Well, I think... you know, I think all these things happen in small increments, and, you know, the sort of food we do at Rumi is quite recent, and obviously built on the back of, you know, our parents wanting to cook and eat a certain way, and then the generation after them that comes along, and then somebody has the courage or the aspiration to open a little falafel shop or a little Lebanese restaurant or something like that. So, you know, none of these things happen in isolation. They're all built on the people before us. So, you know, it's... Well, if we look at it, it's taken, you know, 60 years to get to this point where, you know, Middle Eastern food is considered part of the you know, the Australian palate now.
Yeah. I remember my mum experimenting with falafel in the late 70s, early 80s, and people going, what are you doing? What is this weirdness? You know, you turn up with it in your lunchbox and you get some funny looks.
Yeah.
But, I mean, did you notice any chances, for example, after 9/11 in punters' attitudes to the food?
No, not to the food, but there's definitely an awareness of what we were doing. And, you know, Rumi has always sort of tried to provide a counter-narrative to what we hear all the time. And, you know, and not to brush over the issues of people of Middle Eastern appearance, but that's not all we do, you know. So we've always been trying to tell this alternative story. And, you know, Rumi's a sort of famous poet and mystic, you know, known all over the world. And, you know, I'd often say to people, well, you know, he's of Middle Eastern appearance too. You know,
so, yep, there's a lot going on. As you say, it's complicated, rich, fascinating history, Lebanese history. You also talk in the book about these ideas of, like, authenticity in food. Like, how much are you allowed to experiment with Lebanese food?
Well, that's a tricky one because, you know, where do you draw the line of authenticity? You know, where is Lebanon even? For, you know, so for example, I see the similarities between the region, not so much the differences. So, you know, whether it's Lebanese or Syrian or Turkish, I can definitely see all the crossover there. So growing up in Australia and being born in Australia, for me, I see the similarities more than the differences. But
it gives you wiggle room, doesn't it, in a way?
Well, for me, it was able to broaden the horizon of what I could cook. And, you know, also I think I tie that to people's thought as well. You know, if you're so rigid in your thought about food, you're probably very rigid in your thought about how you see the world, I think. You know, so but I think on authenticity of food, you know, do we draw the line at, you know, pre-America? Because before we discovered America, or, you know, Christopher Columbus did what's called the Columbian Exchange, there was no peppers, there was no tomatoes, there was no potatoes.
That's
all the Irish would have died.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we would have been just impoverished with our tastes. But I was reading how for some migrants and children of migrants, it can feel a bit like a betrayal to experiment with the recipes that you've brought over or that your mum has made religiously the same way for their entire life.
Yeah, look, I think many migrants feel that need to preserve what they came with. Because, you know, let's use the Lebanese example. If you're in Lebanon and you make hummus out of potato, or you make hummus out of beetroot or whatever, you're not going to be questioned as to whether you're Lebanese. You know, you're always going to be Lebanese. But if you do it here, there's that question of, you know, have you left behind what your origins are.
Wow. Are you some kind of inner city trendy now because you put beetroot in yours?
Yes.
Well, tell us about
this. Guilty as accused.
Joseph Aboud is who we're speaking to, who's made some beautiful food in a beautiful restaurant over the years. It's called Rumi in Melbourne. And he's written a book about it too, or about, you know, lots of things. It's called Rumi, Food of Middle Eastern Appearance. And we'll talk soon too to someone who knows intimately the communal aspect, the conversational and the political aspects of these kinds of food and sharing them. And we'll talk about what that's meant in her case too. But Joseph, let's talk about that powerful hummus experience that you say was like an epiphany. It was in Damascus. It was literally a road to Damascus experience. Really,
yeah. So, you know, mum had always made hummus for the table growing up, and it's not something that I ever particularly liked and still don't particularly like her hummus. Ooh, you know, it's more of a little just an add-on as opposed to a hero. And this particular morning, and it sounds very cliche, but, you know, get up, leave the hostel very early and go for a walk and wander the streets of Damascus. And, you know, you see the window with the steam coming out, and you follow the dog and you turn around the corner and some old boy is there, you know, stirring his chickpeas and, you know, mashes them in front of you. They're still warm, tahini, garlic, lemon, you know, fresh bread. And that's, I didn't know that you could eat hummus like that, you know. And then this was on a trip that I sort of took overland from China, then arrived in Lebanon, and my uncle took me to a restaurant that pretty much just does hummus and, ful, which is broad beans, and those sorts of dishes. And I'd never knew that you could have Lebanese foods like that. So, you know, this is as an adult, growing up in a Lebanese household, but still, you know, still learning what it's like over there. And I suppose that inspired some of the ideas that we've put through at Rumi and various other places.
I love how you just slightly skip over the fact that you went over the entire Silk Road, just kind of sampling food along the way. Yeah, I started in China and ended up. But I mean, all through that trip, China, Pakistan, Iran, Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, there's fantastic traditions of hospitality and communal eating, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's, it wasn't a thought at the time, but no doubt inspired what we went on to do. I think the tea houses of Iran were a really big inspiration, that idea of just sort of, something that was quite foreign to us in Melbourne, where it's a big coffee culture. And interestingly, as a side note, at risk of boring you, they're still called coffee houses, even though they drink tea. But because coffee was associated with political uprisings and cafes was where everyone met goes way back. But it's interesting that they're still called coffee houses. A lot of them. Yeah.
That intersection of coffee and food and politics and little houses is going to come in. No, and it's very, very relevant to our discussion today. We're speaking with Joseph Aboud. In a moment, we'll be speaking with Hanna Asafiri too, from the Moroccan Soup Bar, another Melbourne institution. I do need to ask you, Joseph, if you've got your favourite hummus recipe that you would like to share with us, but I know some people have very secret ingredients.
No, all my secrets are in the book. In the cookbook. Look, I think that something like hummus is, you really almost, there is no recipe really, you know. It's, some people really love it really lemony, some people love it lots of garlic, some people really like tahini. I think depends on the tahini that you buy. If you have a really beautiful, rich sort of roasty tahini and you love that flavour. So I think the gist of the book in general actually is, you know, cook to the way you want it to cook. There's a few pointers, I think, you know, but they're no secrets, you know, mashing the chickpeas when they're hot and, you know, things like that just to help get that really smooth texture. Some people don't even like the smooth texture. Some people, you know, like it sort of a bit sort of chunky and, you know, which is delicious as well.
And some people hand peel their chickpeas apparently, which is a bridge too far for me. Just finally, I was fascinated, Joseph, that apparently your mum still doesn't trust you with a knife. Like, you did not learn to cook in the home kitchen.
No, definitely not. And I'm sure Hannah will talk more about this, but the man's place wasn't in the kitchen and, you know, still seems to be a problem to mum, you know, not in a bad way, just like, she always offers to help at the restaurant, even though she, you know, she wouldn't be able to keep up with what we do, but she still feels that she'd be able to do better than we could, or, you know. But, yeah, always, you know, be careful with that knife oh, my God, Mum, what are you talking about? You know, and just generally the idea of me cooking Middle Eastern food or Lebanese food isn't because we don't do the classics, it's very hard for her to answer and say, oh, we Joseph has a Lebanese restaurant. So she always balks before answering that question, as do I, really. If someone says, oh, you got a Lebanese restaurant, I say, Yeah, depends who's asking.
Excellent. Do I put little bits of ground beef on my hummus? Maybe. Yeah. Do I put beetroot in it? Yeah. Ask me tomorrow. Joseph Abud, it's been lovely chatting with you about the history of your family and food and hummus in particular. Thanks so much.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
It's a great pleasure. So many texts coming in on this too. My grandma had olive oil, brandy and 4711 on the same shelf at the sideboard, says Faye in Fitzroy. That's a very strong smelling German eau de cologne. Interesting. Another from Angela in Canberra says, I have strong memories of my mother buying food from a delicatessen in Manuka, Canberra suburb, about 1953-54. It always had a delicious smell, although not there anymore. Plenty more have opened since. I'm very glad to hear that, Angela. And I have Lebanese heritage, says another person. My father, who recently passed away, came to Australia in the 50s and he made the best spicy, delicious tabbouleh. That's another thing that can vary widely and beautifully. Hannah Asafiri is very well known in Melbourne for her restaurant, the Moroccan Soup Bar, which blends amazing vegetarian food with social justice initiatives and communal conversation and the chickpea bake that's to die for. Hannah's cooking is influenced by her mother's Lebanese heritage and her father's Moroccan heritage. And her new memoir is called Hannah, The Audacity to Be Free. Great to have you on the program, Hannah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I'm going back now to the 90s or whenever you started that restaurant. I rocked up and was like, oh, my God, this is amazing. Because, you know, it was so different from what we had been to at the time. The menu was spoken. You were right there front and centre. The food was all incredible. A friend of mine had a panic attack after, like, the chickpea bake because the butter was so rich. I was like, mixed so good memories. But tell us a little bit about how you came to that, because your childhood in the memoir is pretty difficult, moving between Lebanon and Australia, war, poverty, and it sounds like you had to do quite a lot of the practical work of survival for your family.
I mean, I start by saying that was my normal. And when that is your normal, it's a world you navigate and you learn to navigate with the available tools to you, particularly as a kid. You're trying to make sense of the world around you. So we were born here and Mum often alienated, marginalised, didn't. And we spoke earlier of assimilation and integration and those things were not available to her. So lived within the four walls and, as a result, she was often very depressed and longing in that sense of longing for home and belonging, which we, I think, ultimately it transmits to the children in the house. So we ended up going to Lebanon, which is this place that she was really longing for, home, and where we thought she'd be happy, and only to be met with the social, local, cultural tensions, everything from the gender roles to then being in a very warring environment where what was at stake was your safety, was your sense of can you eat tomorrow? And so we went abruptly from one world to another as a child. And as a child, you don't make sense of the politics of it. You're simply trying to survive and feel safe. And so in Mum and through wars, we were the conditioning in Lebanon, and I don't know what it's like for you, Joseph, men, and you mentioned men have and occupy the public spaces and women occupy private spaces and kitchens. And it is only in the kitchens and in those private spaces that we were genuinely real as women.
And you're right that, you know, women were happy in the kitchen. They were fun and playful.
And to the outside world in those formal settings, salons and cafes and whatever else, they presented a version of themselves that they wanted to be and upheld traditions that were nonsensical in my experience. Particularly as a child during war, the expectation and in public spaces, it was only men in the main. I don't know how much that's changed now. So even going to the bakery to get some bread, there was only men. And my brother would go and come back empty-handed. And we had five mouths to feed. So I would go as a young'un and push between all these men and come back with the bread to feed the family. And then, bizarrely, the expectation that I would then behave like a girl again. And I found that dissonance really troublesome. And at the same time, it taught me that, you know, these categories and expectations and norms and are ridiculous and nonsensical. They don't make sense. So it gave me the opportunity to start defying conventions. Going, no, I want to be out there. And if you expect me to be out there, you can't then expect me not to be afforded the privileges of what is out there.
Well, and fast forward a few years, quite a few years and quite a lot of water under the bridge. You had your own difficult personal story of escaping violence in a marriage with your kids. And then you decide to open this restaurant, but to simultaneously make it a place of gathering and conversation and beautiful food, but also a place that supports women who are in difficult circumstances. How do you do that? How do you run a business that's also supporting the staff?
Well, I think it's a place that supports the women. So it's centred on very different values. Whilst it's a business that's sustainable, it is not driven by the objectives and the business plan and the overarching drivers of business. It is driven by a set of values and principles and foundations that centre women, that give voice to and lifting other women in order that they transition from disadvantage, crisis, to independence in a meaningful way. And because kitchens were the safest space for me and the most honest, I wanted to take the very traditions which subjugate women, where they are taken for granted. They cook at home and it's really unrewarded and unrecognised and the labour of women. And I wanted to be able to turn that on its head and make it a source of empowerment. How do we start where women are at and take them on a journey in order that they can then, that their independence can then enrich and enable and support others in harm's way.
You also take the customers on a journey,
absolutely,
don't you?
Absolutely, yes.
Because it's a bit surprising for people that they're in for quite a lot of conversation when they're eating.
Yes. So it was founded on two strong pillars. One is obviously centering women, and the other is hospitality. We know how to do hospitality well in our cultures, and that medium of a printed menu, and I think it puts distance between you and community. So nothing more than a set of convictions of there's that flagpole, and that flagpole is about our humanity, and let's take everybody on a journey. And some of it was quite accidental, in all honesty. The spoken menu was simply, we could not afford to print menus, and yet it was important. And we learnt that it was important as a way of engagement. And whilst we did fumble our way through, and the community embraced the mission, if you like, of our betterment, that we are, and we're not into assimilation, interestingly, Joseph, because I'm a little more about a mosaic.
Yeah, and sharing is not about assimilation, is
that's
it? Sharing
right.
is about everyone coming to the table.
And it's about standing in your authentic expression and inviting others in and being enriched by that through respect that is afforded to others to join you in that communal kind of existence.
So you've done things like Speed Date a Muslim, where
yes.
you can come and ask anyone anything, a really quite crucial political and cultural moments in our history. And there's the communal aspect. When you first started, you know, share plates were not a huge thing in particularly the Melbourne dining scene. How have customers responded to both the kind of political and social aspects and the cuisine aspects of what you do?
Look, I think, that we're still here speaks to the resonance of the message, the food. So we don't compromise on the quality of the food, basic. We don't serve what we don't eat. And it is made with the labour, the physical labour from chopping the, smashing the garlic because you exude very different flavours to just mincing it in a machine. And the journey and the love and the meaning that is had for women as part of their transition. And that is offered up and infused in the flavours. And I call our food, it's infused with social justice flavours. And at the same time, Sorry, what was the other part of your question?
Oh, how the customers responded to, you know, they're getting a political education as well as a culinary one.
Well, they're getting invited. They're getting invited to have a different conversation to the one that's on offer. And I don't know if you've noticed, we live in a world that is becoming so more polarised, so more divided, and very little meaningful engagement is available. And I've stepped into Speed Data Muslim and all making random announcements at the Moroccan Super because they were defining moments for us and as a nation, and because I feel the responsibility to the community that's placed that responsibility onto me as their surrogate aunt, which I call myself. So when we were called to the same-sex marriage debate, I found it excruciating to hear some of the judgments and the prejudice, ill-informed, not because these people were bad, but we've given them permission to have these conversations when we shouldn't have. So I felt the need to interject in the middle of a dinner service and say, actually, you can have your opinion, but importantly, the conversation should be, should people be afforded dignity and respect? And when you reframe it, most people say, yes, of course they should. So community has continued to resonate. And, you know, the proudest moments for me are when you see somebody over two decades who's grown and then stepped into an artist or a musician or a politician and conveying very similar sentiments despite the climate that's divisive that we find ourselves in. So for me, that is the validation and affirmation of women and of women in spaces trying to make inroads in a world so polarised.
It's people are often much more receptive to new ideas and new ways to reflect when they're sitting down and sharing food. Yeah, I certainly am. Hannah Asafiri, it's been great to chat with you too on Life Matters today. Thank you for coming
in. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hannah runs the Moroccan Soup Bar, an institution in Melbourne, and her memoir's just been published. It's called Hannah, The Audacity to Be Free. And you heard earlier too from chef and author Joseph Aboud, whose book is called Rumi, Food of Middle Eastern Appearance.
It's easier than ever to hear your favourite local and national ABC radio stations, live and on demand on the ABC Listen app.